This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents My Sweet Audrina by V.C. Andrews. Read by Rebecca Ross.
Buried Gifts.
"No, Papa!" I screamed, panic in my voice, terror all around me. "Come back! Don't make me stay in here all by myself!"
"You're not alone,"
he called to me from the other side of the door.
"I'll stay right here, watching through the keyhole, listening, praying. Nothing but good can come from rocking in that chair."
I squeezed my eyes shut and heard the wind chimes clamoring louder, much louder now. I told myself, as I'd told myself before, that there was nothing to be afraid of. The dead couldn't harm anyone. But if they couldn't, why was I so terrified? I heard Papa's soft voice outside the locked door.
"You do have her gifts, Audrina. You do."
"Papa," I wailed for one last time, "please don't make me..."
"Oh,"
he said heavily, sighing.
"Why do I have to force you? Why can't you just believe? Lean back in the rocker, put your head against the high back, hold the chair arms and begin to rock. Sing if it helps to wash your mind clean of fear, of worries, of desires and emotions. Sing and sing until you become an empty pitcher."
Oh yes, I'd heard this before. I knew what he was doing. He was trying to turn me into the first Audrina. Part 1. White Fern. There was something strange about the house where I grew up. There were shadows in the corners and whispers on the stairs, and time was as irrelevant as honesty, though how I knew that, I couldn't say. There was a war going on in our house. A silent war that sounded no guns, and the bodies that fell were only wishes that died, and the bullets were only words, and the blood that spilled was always called pride. Though I'd never been to school, and I was 7 years old and it was high time I was in school, it seemed I knew all about the Civil War. Around me, the Civil War was still being waged, and though the future might stretch ahead for billions of years, it was still the war we'd never forget. For our pride had been injured, and our passions were lingering on. We'd lost that battle, better won by the opposite side. Maybe that's why it still kept hurting. Mama and my Aunt Elsbeth always said that men liked violent discussions about wars better than any other topic, but if there were other wars of any importance at all, they were never discussed in our house. Papa would read any book, see any movie, cut out any magazine photo that represented that war between brothers, even though his ancestors had fought against my maternal ones. He was Yankee-born, but a Southerner by preference. At the dinner table, he'd recount the plots of the long novels he read about General Robert E. Lee and give grisly accounts of all the bloody battles. And if most of what he read charmed me, it did not charm either my aunt, who preferred the television, or my mother, who preferred to read her own books, claiming Papa left out the best parts, which weren't fit for young ears to hear. That meant my ears and my cousin Vera's ears. Though most of the world believed Vera to be my sister, I knew she was my unmarried aunt's illegitimate daughter, and that we had to shield her from the scorn of society by pretending she was my legitimate older sister. I did have a legitimate older sister, too, but she had died before I was born. Her name was also Audrina, and even though she had been dead a long time, still she lingered on. My papa never forgot the first and best Audrina, and still hoped that someday I would be as special as she was. My cousin Vera liked people to think she was my sister. I didn't know her true age, for she refused to tell me that. Nobody in our house ever revealed their ages. Only my age was talked about all the time. It was Vera's boast that she could be any age she wanted to be. 10, 12, 15, and even 20. With a few elegant and sophisticated postures, truly she did change her manner and expression. She could look very mature or very childlike, depending on her mood. She liked to ridicule me because I was so uncertain about time. Often Vera told me I'd hatched full-blown from a giant ostrich egg at the age of 7. She always said that I had inherited that bird's famous habit of sticking its head in the sand and pretending nothing in the world was wrong. She didn't know about my dreams and the ugliness they gave me. From the very beginning, I knew Vera was my enemy even when she pretended to be my friend. Though I wanted her for my friend in the worst way, I knew she hated me. She was jealous because I was an Adrina and she wasn't. Oh, how I wanted Vera to like and admire me, as sometimes I really liked and admired her. I envied her, too, because she was normal and didn't have to try to be like someone who was dead. No one seemed to care if Vera wasn't special. No one except Vera. Vera was fond of telling me that I wasn't really special either. I was merely strange. To tell the truth, I thought there was something strange about me, too. I seemed to be unable to recall anything about my early childhood. I couldn't remember anything about the past, what I had done the week or even the day before. I didn't know how I had learned the things I knew, or why I seemed to know some things I shouldn't. The many clocks scattered throughout our giant house confused me even more. The grandfather clocks in the halls chimed out different hours. The cuckoos and their wooden Swiss clocks popped in and out of small ornate doors, each contradicting all the others. The fancy French clock in my parents' bedroom had stopped long ago at midnight or noon, and a Chinese clock ran backwards. To my great distress, though I searched everywhere, there were no calendars in our house, not even old ones, and the newspapers never came on the day they were due. Our only magazines were old ones, stacked in closets, hidden in the attic. Nobody threw anything away in our house. It was kept, saved for our descendants so they could sell it one day and make a fortune. Much of my insecurity had to do with the first Adrina, who had died exactly 9 years before I was born. She had died mysteriously in the woods after cruel and heartless boys had spoiled her in some indescribable way. And because of her, I was never supposed to enter the woods, even to go to school. And the woods were all around us, almost smothering us. They embraced us on three sides, the River Lyle on the fourth. To go anywhere, we had to travel through the woods. Everywhere in our home, photographs of the first and best Adrina were scattered. On Papa's desk, there were three framed portraits of her, at age 1, 2, and 3. There was not one single baby picture of me. Not one. And that hurt. The first Adrina had been a beautiful little girl, and when I looked at her photographs, I felt oddly haunted. Wanting to be her so badly, I ached inside. I wanted to be her so I'd feel as loved, as special as everyone said she had been. And then again, contrarily, I wanted more than anything to be myself, and on my own merits gain the love I felt denied me. Oh, the tales Papa could tell me about the wonders of his first daughter, and every one he told made me know I was not the best Adrina, not the perfect and special one, only the second and inferior one. My parents kept the first Adrina's bedroom like a shrine for a dead princess. It was left exactly as it had been on the day she met her fate, which was never explained in detail to me. That room was so full of toys it seemed more a playroom than a bedroom. Mama herself cleaned that room, and she hated housework. Just to see her room made me realize nothing had been too good for her, while my bedroom lacked toy shelves and her vast array of playthings. I felt cheated. Cheated of a real childhood. Adrina the first and best had stolen my youth, and everyone talked so much about her that I couldn't remember anything about me. I believed it was because of her that my memory was so full of holes. Papa would try to fill those holes by putting me in her rocking chair and making me rock and sing until I became the empty pitcher that would fill with everything. He wanted me to fill with her memories and capture her special powers since she was dead and didn't need them anymore. And as if one ghost weren't enough, we had a second who came every Tuesday at 4. Tea time, we called Aunt Mercy Marie's day. There she'd sit on the piano in her black and white photograph in a silver frame, her fat face beaming a vacuous smile, her pale blue eyes staring out as if she could see us when she couldn't. She was dead and yet undead, just like my dead sister. My aunt and my mother would speak for Aunt Mercy Marie, and through her they would let loose all the venom they held back and saved for tea times. Strangely enough, my cousin Vera enjoyed these Tuesday tea times so much she'd find any reason to play hooky from school, just to be there and hear all the ugly things my mother and her half-sister would say to one another. They were White Fern sisters, and once upon a far-ago time, that had meant something wonderful. Now, it meant something sad, but they would never tell me exactly what. Long ago, the White Fern family had been the most notable family in our Tidewater section of Virginia, giving the country senators and vice presidents. But we'd fallen out of favor not just with the villagers, but also with everyone, and we were no longer honored or even respected. Our house was far from the nearest city of any size. White Fern Village was 15 miles down a lonely country road, but we seldom went there. It was as if, long ago, some secret war had been declared, and we in our castle, as Papa liked to call our home, were hated by the serfs in the lowlands. If any place in our vicinity could be called Highlands, it was the slight hill on which White Fern sat. Papa had to drive 30 miles to and from his stock brokerage office. All the friends we had lived in the city. Our nearest neighbors were 12 miles away as a car drove, 5 as a crow flew. Papa drove our only car to work, leaving all of us without transportation. So often my Aunt Elsbeth would bemoan the day she'd sold her small car to buy the TV set. My aunt, who'd never been married, loved her portable television set with a 12-inch screen. She seldom allowed me to watch, though her daughter Vera could watch as much as she liked when she was home from school. That was another thing I couldn't understand. Why Vera was allowed to go to school when I couldn't go. School was dangerous for me, but not for Vera. Naturally, I presumed there had to be something terribly wrong with me. My parents had to hide me away to keep me safe, if not from outsiders, then from myself. That was the scariest thought of all. At the age of 7, while other children boarded yellow buses and rode off giggling and having fun, I sat down at the kitchen table and was taught how to read, write, add, and subtract by my mother, who played the piano beautifully but was not good at teaching anything but how to play the piano. Fortunately, or maybe not, my Aunt Elsbeth was there to help. She had once been a grade school teacher with ready slaps to deliver any boy who dared to call her a nasty name. Just one slap too many, and the parents had seen that my aunt was fired. Though she tried for many a year to find another teaching position, the word was out. My aunt had a ferocious temper and a ready hand. Aunt Elsbeth, like her daughter Vera, also had ready comments to criticize our way of living. According to my aunt, we were all as antediluvian as the house in which we lived, out of sync with the rest of the world, she'd say. In my dreams of home, White Fern loomed up high and white against a dark and stormy sky, frightening to behold. It threatened in the night, but in the day it welcomed me with open arms. I had a habit of sitting outside on the lawn and admiring the grandness of White Fern. It was a gingerbread Victorian house of many frills, with its white paint peeling, its dark blinds loose and crooked. It had 3 stories, with an attic and a basement toward the back half of the house, where the spacious lawn inclined toward the River Lyle. As I stared at that house, I thought I had much in common with it. We were both antediluvian and out of sync. Our windows were myriad, many of them beautiful stained glass. The shutters about to fall off were so darkly red they appeared black from a distance, like dried blood. From the outside, the most marvelous thing of all were the balustrades on all the many porches, balconies, and verandas, designed to look like stylized wood ferns. In the very center of the dark roof was a round cupola with a copper roof now turned green from tarnish. It formed a point that was topped by a golden ball whose gold leaf was coming off bit by bit each time it rained. The cupola was about 14 feet in diameter, and every single one of its many windows was made of leaded stained glass, with scenes to represent the angels of life and death. Inside and out, ferns cascaded everywhere from wicker stands. There were other plants, but the ferns seemed to steal what moisture there was in the air, so soon all other plants died. On stealthy, timid feet, I played my small, lonely games in the great foyer, where the stained glass from the double front doors threw colorful patterns on the floor. Rapier-sharp colors sometimes, stabbing into my brain and punching holes there. I also had little rhymes Vera had taught me that I said to protect myself from the colors. Step on black, live forever in a shack. Step on green, never be clean. Step on blue, work will never be through. Step on yellow, hear the world bellow. Step on red, soon be dead. Just so I wouldn't have to step on any color, I stole along the walls, keeping to the shadows, listening to the clocks ticking away the wrong times and the silly cuckoos going crazy in the night. When the wind blew hard, the shutters banged and the floors creaked. The furnace in the basement coughed, sputtered, groaned, and the wind chimes in the cupola tinkled, tinkled. Yet in the daytime, there were things so wondrously grand in our house that I felt like Alice lost in a house of jewels. Art Deco lamps and objet d'art were scattered hither and yon. Tiffany lamps rose up to throw more colors to pattern the walls. Crystal prisms dangled from lampshades, from wall sconces, from chandeliers, from gas lamps, catching colors, refracting rainbows that flashed like lightning whenever sunlight managed to steal through the lace curtains. We had a fireplace in every room. There were 8 of marble, many of elegantly carved wood, and none were made of brick. Brick was not elegant enough for our type of house that seemed to despise simplicity. Our ceilings were high and carved with elaborate designs, making frames for biblical or romantic scenes. In the olden days, people had, or so it seemed to my young eyes, either too many clothes on or too little that wanted to stay in place. I wondered why the biblical scenes usually had more flesh showing than the ones where people were decidedly wicked. One could hardly believe those near-naked people were sincerely trying to follow where God would lead them. Bare bosoms of impressive proportions protruded brazenly in every room of our house but mine. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and several other dead-eyed presidents gazed day after day at the naked lady lying on a chaise across the way as she forever dropped grapes into her gaping mouth. Naked baby boys flew about shamelessly, shooting aimless arrows, but the men always modestly hid their maleness behind some strategically placed leaf or graceful flow of drapery. Women were not so apt to hide what they had, I'd often thought as I gazed at them. They looked shy, but acted bold. Aunt Elsbeth had come up behind me once and explained bitterly that since most artists were men, it was only natural for them to delight in exploiting the nude female figure.
"Don't judge women by what you see in paintings and statues. Judge them only by what you yourself know about the women in your life. The day any man understands any woman will be the day the world comes to an end. Men are hateful, contrary creatures who say they want goddesses to put on pedestals. Once they have them up there, they rip off the halo, tear off the gown, slice off the wings so they can't fly, and then kick the pedestal away so the woman falls at his feet and he can scream out as he kicks her, tramp, or worse."
To hear my Aunt Elsbeth talk, one would think she'd been married 12 or more times, and 1,000 men had disappointed her. As far as I knew, only one man had. Our furniture had many styles, all of them fancy. It seemed each chair, each table, each sofa, lamp, pillow, hassock, desk was in competition, trying to outdo the others. Although Aunt Elspeth complained about the furniture, Mama would catch hold of my hand and lead me reverently from room to room, explaining that this table was a Renaissance Revival centerpiece made by Berkeley and Gay, Grand Rapids, Michigan. All antiques, Adrina, all worth their weight in gold. The bed in my room is 500 years old. Once kings and queens slept behind its curtains. Behind us, my aunt would snort her contempt and disbelief. Other people had electricity in all their rooms. We had electricity only in our kitchen and bathrooms. In other rooms, we used gas lamps because Mama thought them more flattering to her complexion. My aunt thought them a pain in, but I wasn't supposed to use some of the words my aunt said readily. Even more than gas lamps, Mama loved candles burning and logs in the fireplace snapping and crackling and making shadows dance on the dark paneled walls. Our kitchen stuck out like a sore thumb with all its modern gadgets that made life bearable for Mama, who hated any kind of hard work, but loved cooking the gourmet meals my father had to have. The room we all favored most was the Roman Revival Salon. On its royal purple velvet lounging chaise, with the gold cording tarnished and falling off where it wasn't fastened by fancy tassels, Mama would lie dressed in some filmy negligee or a soft summer dress. She didn't seem to notice that the stuffing was coming out and the springs poked through in a few places. Sprawled elegantly on that chaise, she'd read her romances and occasionally lift her eyes to stare dreamily off into space. I guessed she was imagining herself in the arms of the handsome lover on the colorful cover of her paperback novel. I told myself bravely that someday I was going to have the nerve to read novels like that, wicked and beautiful at the same time. Though how I knew they were wicked books I couldn't say, since I'd never read one. But almost naked people on the cover seemed awfully wicked. Papa's huge round home office, directly under the cupola, held thousands of old, old books, and many fine editions of classics that nobody read but me and Aunt Elspeth. Papa said he didn't have time to read them, but he kept on adding to our leather-bound collection as if hoping all his friends would think he read them. Mama hid her paperbacks in her bedroom closets and pretended that she, too, loved the high-minded tales printed on fine paper and bound with beautiful leather. Some of those classic books contained very wicked material, according to my cousin Vera, who always informed me about what was or was not wicked. I liked to watch Mama lying on her couch. Behind her was a concert-sized grand piano that her father had given her when she had won a gold medal in a music competition. Many a time she'd told me she could have gone on to play in all the best concert halls, but Papa hadn't wanted a professional musician for his wife. "Don't expect to have too many talents, Adrina. Men won't approve if it's likely you'll earn more money than they do." Downward her hand would drift. Without even looking, she would cleverly find the very piece of chocolate she wanted and pop it into her mouth. My father often warned her about eating too much chocolate and becoming fat, but she never did. My mother was tall, curvy where she should be, and slender in all the places a woman should be. My papa often told me she was the greatest beauty on the East Coast and had been the catch of the season at her debutante ball. Many a handsome and rich man had asked for my mama's hand in marriage, but it had been Damien Jonathan Adair who had swept my mother off her feet with his dashing dark good looks and his winning charm. "He towered over every other man in my life, Adrina," my mother would tell me. "When your father came back from the sea, all the girls went gaga just to have him in the room. I felt so lucky when he had eyes only for me." Then she'd frown as if remembering some other girl Papa might have had eyes for. Vera liked to joke that my father had married my mother only because he admired her hair color so much. "Witchy hair," Vera called Mama's hair and mine. "Chameleon hair," Papa often called it. It was strange hair, and at times I believed Vera was right. Our hair didn't know which color it was supposed to be and was, instead, all colors. Flaxen blonde with gold, auburn, bright red, chestnut brown, copper, and even some white. Papa loved the strange prism-like color of our hair. I believed he'd ordered God to give me the kind of hair I had. If he hadn't, Papa might have sent me back. For the first, Adrina also had chameleon hair. My papa, 6'5" and weighing well over 200 pounds, was the tallest man I had ever seen, though Vera was always telling me there were many men who were taller, especially basketball players. Papa's hair was the darkest black, looking blue sometimes in the sunlight. He had beautiful almond-shaped eyes, so brown they appeared black, and his lashes were so long and thick they appeared false, even though they weren't. I knew. I'd tried to pull them off after I saw Mama glue some false ones on. His eyes were slick as oil, scary and wonderful, especially when they glittered. He had smooth, soft skin that often appeared ruddy in the winters and richly bronze in the summers. When Mama was displeased with Papa and his selfish ways of spending more on himself than on her, she'd call him a dandy and a fop, though what those words meant I didn't know. I suspected she meant that my huge, powerful Papa cared more about clothes than he cared about principles. He feared growing old, especially feared losing his hair. He checked his hairbrush each day, almost counting the hairs he found there. He saw the dentist 4 times a year. He flossed his teeth so often, Mama grew disgusted. His doctor checked him over as much as the dentist did. He fretted about minor flaws no one would ever notice but him, such as thick, horny toenails he had difficulty clipping. Yet when he smiled, his charm was irresistible. Principles were another thing I didn't understand, except Mama often said that Papa lacked them. Again, I vaguely guessed she meant Papa wanted what he wanted, and no one had better get in his way and try to prevent him from taking what he had to have. Yet sometimes when he was with me, and he was tender and loving, he'd give me my way. But only sometimes. There were other times. Terrible other times. It had been agreed when my aunt came back to live here, when Vera was only 1 year old, that she would do all the housework in exchange for her board and keep, while my mother did the cooking. Unreasonably, my aunt wanted to do the cooking, which she considered easier, instead of the housework, but no one could eat anything my aunt prepared. Mama despised housework, but she could throw anything into a pot or bowl without measuring, and it would come out tasting divine. Papa said she was a creative cook because she had an artist's mind, while Ellie, as only he called her, was born to be some man's slave. How my aunt glared when he said mean things like that. My aunt was a fearsome woman. Tall, lean, and mean was my father's description.
"It's no wonder no man wants to marry you,"
my father often teased my aunt.
"You've got the tongue of a shrew."
Not only did she have a sharp tongue, as mean for me as for Vera, but she also had her golden rule about sparing the rod and spoiling the child. Neither Vera nor I were spared when she was in charge. Fortunately, my parents seldom left us alone with her. In some ways, it seemed like my aunt disliked her daughter even more than she disliked me. It had always been my belief that women were born to be loving mothers. Then, when I gave that more thought, I couldn't remember how I had arrived at that conclusion. Mama liked for my aunt to chastise Vera, so then she could open her arms wide and welcome Vera into them, saying time and again to Vera, "It's all right. I'll love you even if your own mother can't."
"That's the weakness of being you, Lucietta," said my aunt sharply. "You can give love to anything."
As if her own daughter, Vera, was less than human. Never would my Aunt Elspeth name the man who was Vera's father.
"He was a cheat and a liar. I don't want to remember his name," she'd say with scorn.
It was so difficult to understand what was going on in our house. Treacherous undercurrents, like the rivers that ran into the sea that wasn't so very far away. It was true my aunt was tall. Her face was long, and she was skinny, even if she did eat 3 times more than my mother. Sometimes when Papa said cruel things to my aunt, her already thin lips would purse together to become a fine line. Her nostrils would flare. Her hands would tighten into fists, as if she'd like to belt him one if she only had the nerve. Maybe it was Aunt Elspeth who kept our city friends from coming more often. There had to be some reason why they came only when we threw a party. Then Mama said our friends popped out of the woodwork like insects to come feast on the picnic. Papa adored all parties until they were over. Then, for one reason or another, He would jump on Mama and punish her for some trivial thing he called a social error, such as looking at a handsome man for too long or dancing with him too many times. Oh, it was difficult being a wife, I could tell. One never knew just what to do or how friendly to be. Mama was expected to play the piano to entertain while people danced or sang, but she wasn't supposed to play so well that some people cried and told her later that she'd been a fool to marry and give up her musical career. No casual callers ever came to our doors. No salesmen were allowed either. Signs were posted everywhere, "No solicitors allowed," and "Beware of the dog," and "Keep off, this is private property, trespassers will be prosecuted." I often went to bed feeling unhappy with my life, feeling an undercurrent that was pulling my feet from under me, and I was floundering, floundering, bound to sink and drown. It seemed I heard a voice whispering, telling me there were rivers to cross and places to go, but I'd never go anywhere. There were people to know and fun to have, but I wouldn't experience any of that. I woke up and heard the tinkle of the whispering wind chimes telling me over and over that I belonged where I was, and here would I stay forevermore, and nothing I did would matter in the long run. Shivering, I hugged my arms over my thin chest. In my ears, I heard Papa's voice saying over and over again,
"This is where you belong, safe with Papa. Safe in your home."
Why did I have to have an older sister dead and in her grave at the age of 9? Why did I have to be named after a dead girl? It seemed peculiar, unnatural. I hated the first Adrena, the best Adrena, the good and perfect and never wrong Adrena. Yet I had to replace her if ever I was to win a permanent place in Papa's heart. I hated the ritual of visiting her grave every Sunday after church services and putting flowers there bought from a florist, as if the flowers from our yard weren't good enough. In the morning, I ran to Papa, and right away he picked me up and held me close as the grandfather clocks in the hallways relentlessly ticked on. All about us, the house was as silent as a grave, as if waiting for death to come and take us all, as it had taken the first and best Adrena. Oh, how I hated and envied my older dead sister. How cursed I felt to bear her name. "Where is everyone?" I whispered, glancing around fearfully.
"Out in the yard,"
he said, hugging me closer.
"It's Saturday, my love. I know time isn't important to you, but it is to me. Time is never important to special people with unusual gifts. Yet for me, the weekend hours are the best ones. I knew you'd be frightened to find yourself alone in an empty house, so I stayed inside while the rest went out to harvest the rewards of their planting."
"Papa, why can't I remember every day like other people? I don't remember last year or the year before. Why?"
"We are all victims of dual heritages,"
he said softly, stroking my hair and gently rocking me back and forth in the rocker that my great-great-great-grandmother had used to nurse her 12 children in.
"Each child inherits genes from both parents, and that determines his or her hair color, eye color, and personality traits. Babies come into the world to be controlled by those genes and by the particular environment that surrounds them. You are still waiting to fill with your dead sister's gifts. When you do, all that is good and beautiful in this world will belong to you, as it belonged to her. While you and I wait for that marvelous day when your empty pitcher is filled, I am doing my damnedest to give you the very best."
At that moment, my aunt and mother came into the kitchen, trailed by Vera, who carried a basket of freshly picked butter beans. Aunt Elsbeth must have overheard most of what Papa had just said, because she remarked sarcastically,
"You should have been a philosopher instead of a stockbroker, Damien. Then maybe someone would care to listen to your words of wisdom."
I stared at her, dredging up from my treacherous memory something I might or might not have dreamed. It could even be a dream that belonged to the first Adrena, who'd been so clever, so beautiful, and so everlastingly perfect. But before I could capture any elusive memory, all were gone. Gone. I sighed, unhappy with myself. Unhappy with the adults who ruled me, with the cousin who insisted she was really my only sister because she wanted to steal my place, when already my place had been stolen by the first and best Adrina, who was a dead Adrina. And now I was supposed to act like her, talk like her, and be everything that she'd been. And where was the real me supposed to go? Sunday came, and as soon as the church services were over, Papa drove, as he always did, straight to the family cemetery near our house, where the name White Fern was engraved on a huge arching gateway through which we slowly drove. Beyond the archway, the cemetery itself had to be approached on foot. We were all dressed in our best and bearing expensive flowers. Papa tugged me from inside the car. I resisted, hating that grave we had to visit and that dead girl who stole everyone's love from me. It seemed this was the first time I could clearly remember the words Papa must have said many times before.
There she lies, my first Adrina.
Sorrowfully, he stared down at the flat grave with the slender white marble headstone bearing my very own name, but her birth and death dates. I wondered when my parents would recover from the shock of her mysterious death. It seemed to me that if 16 years hadn't healed their shock, maybe 90 wouldn't either. I couldn't bear to look at that tombstone, so I stared up into my papa's handsome face so high above. This was the kind of perspective I would never have once I grew up, seeing his strong, square chin from underneath, next his heavy, pouting lower lip, then his flaring nostrils and the fringe of his long, lower, dark lashes, meeting with the upper ones as he blinked back his tears. It was just like looking up at God. He seemed so powerful, so much in control. He smiled at me again.
My first Adrina is in that grave, dead at 9 years of age. That wonderful, special Adrina, just as you are wonderful and special. Never doubt for one moment that you aren't just as wonderful and gifted as she was. Believe in what Papa tells you, and you will never go wrong.
I swallowed. Visiting this grave and hearing about this Adrina always made my throat hurt. Of course I wasn't wonderful or special, yet how could I tell him that when he seemed so convinced? In my childish way, I figured my value to him depended on just how special and wonderful I turned out to be later on. "Oh, Papa," cried Vera, stumbling over to his side and clutching at his hand. I loved her so much, so very much. She was so sweet and wonderful and special and so beautiful. I don't think in a million years there will ever be another like your first Adrina. She flashed a wicked smile my way to tell me again that never would I be as pretty as the first and best and most perfect Adrina. And she was so brilliant in school, too. It's terrible the way she died. Really awful. I'd be so ashamed if that happened to me. So ashamed I'd rather be dead.
Shut up!
Roared Papa, in a voice so mighty that the ducks on the river flew away. He hurried then to put his pot of flowers on that grave, and then he seized my hand and pulled me toward his car. Mama began to cry. Already I knew Vera was right. Whatever wonderful specialness the first Adrina had possessed was buried in the grave with her. In the Kabbalah. Not wanted, not worthy, not pretty, and not special enough were the words I thought as I went up the stairs and into the attic. I wished the first Adrina had never been born. I had to wade through the clutter of old dusty junk before I came to the rusty iron spiraling stairs that would take me through a square opening in the floor that once held a rickety iron guardrail that someday Papa was going to replace. In that octagon room there was a rectangular Turkish rug, all crimsons, golds, and blues. Each day I visited, I combed that fringe with my fingers, as Papa often raked through his dark hair with his fingers when he was enraged or frustrated. There were no furnishings in the cupola, only a pillow for me to sit on. The sunlight through the stained glass windows fell upon the carpet in swirls like bright peacock feathers and confused the designs with patterns of colored light. My legs and arms were patterned too, like impermanent tattoos. High above, dangling down from the apex of the pointed roof, were long rectangles of painted glass, Chinese wind chimes that hung from scarlet silken cords. They hung so high the wind never made them move, yet I often heard them tinkle, tinkle. If just one time they would sway for me while I watched, then I could believe I wasn't crazy. I fell down on the cushion on the rug and began to play with the old paper dolls that I kept lined up around the walls. Each one was named after someone I knew, but since I didn't know too many people, many of the paper dolls had the same names, but only one was named Adrina. It seemed I could vaguely remember once there had been men and boy dolls, but now I had only girls and ladies. I was so absorbed in my thoughts that I didn't hear a sound until suddenly a voice asked, "Are you thinking about me, sweet Adrina?" My head jerked around. There stood Vera in the haunted colored lights of the cupola. Her straight hair was a pale apricot color, unlike any color I'd ever seen, but that wasn't unusual in our family. Her eyes very dark, like her mother's, like my father's. The colors refracted from the many windows cast myriad colored lights on the floor, tattooed patterns on her face, so I'm sure my eyes were lit up just like hers, like many faceted jewels. The cupola was a magic place. "Are you listening to me, Adrina?" she asked, her voice whispery and scary. "Why do you just sit there and not answer? Have you lost your vocal cords as well as your memory?" I hated her being in the cupola. This was my own special private room for trying to figure out what I couldn't remember as I moved the dolls about and pretended they were my family. Truthfully, I was putting the dolls through the years of my life, trying in this way to reconstruct and dredge up the secret that eluded me. Someday, some wonderful day, I hoped to retrieve from those dolls all I couldn't recall, so that I'd be made whole and just as wonderful as that dead sister ever was. Vera's left arm had just come out of a cast. She moved it gingerly as she stepped into my little sanctuary. Despite my off-and-on dislike for Vera, I felt sorry she could break her arm just by banging it against something hard. According to her, she'd had 11 broken bones, and I'd never had any. Little brushes against a table and her wrist fractured. A slighter bump and huge purple bruises came to mar her skin for weeks. If she fell off her bed onto a soft padded carpet, she still broke a leg, an ankle, a forearm, something. "Does your arm still hurt?"
"Don't look at me with pity," ordered Vera, limping into the cupola, then scrunching down on her heels in an awkward way. Her dark eyes bore holes into me. "I have fragile bones, small, delicate bones, and if they break easily, it's because I have more blue blood than you do."
She could have her blue blood if it meant broken bones twice a year. Sometimes when she was so mean to me, I thought God was punishing her, and sometimes I felt guilty because my bones were tough and refused to break even when I occasionally fell. Oh, I wondered again, if the first, best, and most perfect Adrina had been as aristocratic as Vera. "And of course my arm hurts," shrilled Vera, her dark eyes flashing with reds, greens, and blues. "It hurts like hell." Her voice turned plaintive as she went on. "When your arm is broken, it makes you feel so helpless. It's really worse than a broken leg because there are so many things you can't do for yourself. Since you don't eat much, I don't know why your bones don't break more easily than mine. But of course, you must have peasant bones." I didn't know what to say. "There's a boy in my class who looks at me so sympathetically, and he carries my books, and talks to me and asks me all kinds of questions. He's so handsome, you just wouldn't believe it. His name is Arden Lowe. Isn't that an unusual and romantic name for a boy? Adrina, I think he's got a case on me, and he's kissed me twice in the cloakroom." "What's a cloakroom?" "My, are you stupid. Holes in the belfry with bats flying round. That's Papa's sweet Adrina." She giggled as she tossed her challenge. I didn't want to fight, so she went on to tell me more about her boyfriend named Arden Lowe. "His eyes are amber-colored, the prettiest eyes you ever saw. When you get real close, you can see little flecks of green in his eyes. His hair is dark brown with reddish highlights when the sun hits it. He's smart, too. He's a year older than me, but that doesn't mean he's dumb. It just means he's traveled around so much he fell behind in his schoolwork. She sighed and looked dreamy. How old is Arden Lowe? Yesterday I was 20, so Arden was younger, naturally. He doesn't have my kind of talent for being any age I want to be. I guess he's 11, and kind of a baby when I'm 20, but such a good-looking baby. She smiled at me, but I knew darn well she couldn't be more than 12? I went back to my dolls. Adrina, you love those dolls more than you do me. No, I don't. But I wasn't really too sure even as I said that. Then give me the boy and men dolls. All the boy and men dolls are gone, I answered in a funny, tight voice that made Vera open her eyes wide. Where did all the male dolls go, Adrina? She whispered in the weirdest kind of knowing voice that made me shiver. I don't know, I whispered back, somehow afraid. I quickly glanced around with scared eyes. Tinkle, tinkle sounded the chimes above as they dangled perfectly still. I shrank tighter inside. I thought you took them.
You're a bad girl, Adrina. A really wicked girl. Someday you'll find out exactly how bad, and when you do, you'll want to die.
She giggled and drew away. What was wrong with me that she'd want to hurt me time and again? Or was something wrong with her? Like my mother and her sister, were we going to repeat history over and over? Vera's pale, pasty face grinned at me wickedly, seeming to represent all evil. When she turned her head, the colors came to play upon her skin, and her apricot hair turned red, then blue, streaked with violet.
Give me all your dolls, even if the best ones have gone on to hell.
She reached to seize up half a dozen of the closest dolls. Moving lightning fast, I snatched those dolls from her hands. Then, jumping to my feet, I ran about gathering up all the other dolls. Vera crawled to rake my legs with her long fingernails, always filed to sharp points. Still, I managed to hold her off with one foot against her shoulder as I gathered up the last handful of dolls and costumes. With both hands full now, I shoved her with my foot so that she fell backward, and I was off and running down the spiraling stairs at breakneck speed, sure she couldn't catch me. Yet I heard her right behind me, screaming out my name, ordering me to stop.
If I fall, it will be your fault. Your fault.
She added a few filthy names which had no meaning for me at all.
You don't love me, Adrina,
I heard her wail. Her hard-soled shoes made clunking noises on the metal stairs.
If you really loved me like a sister, you'd do what I want and give me everything I want to make up for all the pain I have to suffer.
I heard her stop and gasp for breath.
Adrina, don't you dare hide those dolls. Don't you dare. They belong to me just as much as they belong to you.
No, they didn't. I'd been the one to find them in an old trunk. There was a rule about finders being keepers, and I believed in rules, old adages, maxims. They were tried and tested by time that knew so much more about everything than I did. It was easy to duck out of sight as Vera tediously, clumsily clambered down the steep and narrow stairs. Under a loose floorboard, I stuffed the dolls and all their colorful Edwardian costumes that took them to many an important social function. That's when I heard Vera scream. Oh, golly. She'd fallen again. I ran to where she lay in a crumpled heap. Her left leg was buckled under her in a grotesque way. It was the leg she'd broken twice before. I cringed to see a bit of jagged bone protruding through her torn flesh, which was gushing blood.
"It's your fault,"
she moaned. In so much agony, her pretty face was twisted and ugly.
"It's your fault for not giving me what I wanted. Always your fault, everything bad that happens to me. Your fault. Somebody should give me what I want sometime."
"I'll give you the dolls now," I said weakly, prepared to give her anything she demanded now that she was hurt. "I'll run for your mother and mine first."
"I don't want your damn dolls now," she cried. "Just get out and leave me alone. But for you, I would have had everything. Someday, you're going to pay for all you've stolen from me, Adrina. I'm supposed to be the first and best, not you.
It made me feel sick to back off and leave her alone like she was, broken and in pain, that left leg gushing blood. Then I noticed her left arm was lying there in a peculiar position, too. Oh, dear Lord, it had broken again. Now she'd have a broken arm and a broken leg. But even so, God had not taught Vera anything about humility as I'd been taught, and taught well. How did I know that? Flying down the stairs, I bumped into Papa.
Haven't I told you to stay out of the cupola?
He barked, grabbing hold of my arm and trying to prevent me from reaching my mother.
Don't go up there until I have that guardrail put back. You could fall and hurt yourself.
I didn't want to be the one to tell Papa about Vera's broken bones, yet I had to since he refused to let go of my arm. She's up there bleeding, Papa. Great gobs of blood, and if you don't let go of me and call an ambulance, she might die.
I doubt it,
he said. Still, he did bellow out to Mama.
Call for the ambulance, Lucky. Vera has broken her bones again. My health insurance will cancel my plan if this keeps up.
Still, when it came down to the nitty-gritty, Papa was the one who calmed Vera's fears and sat beside her in the ambulance and held her hand as he wiped away her tears. And on a stretcher, in an ambulance that knew her well, Vera was again on her way to the closest hospital to have yet another cast put on her arm, and on her leg, too. I stood near the front door and watched the ambulance disappear around the bend of our long drive. Both my mother and my aunt refused to go to the hospital again and suffer through all the long hours of waiting and watching that shriveled leg being again put into a cast. The last time she'd broken her leg, Vera's doctor said that if she broke it again, the leg might not grow as long as the other.
"Don't look so worried, darling," comforted Mama. "It wasn't your fault. We have warned Vera time and again not to climb those spiraling stairs. That's why we tell you not to go up there, knowing she'll follow sooner or later to check on what you're doing. And doctors always give you the most dire predictions, thinking how grateful you'll feel when they don't come true. Vera's leg will grow to match the other, though God knows how she manages to break the same one over and over again so consistently." Aunt Elsbeth said nothing at all. It seemed her daughter's broken bones didn't concern her nearly as much as hunting throughout the house for an old vacuum cleaner, which she finally found in the closet under the back stairs. She headed toward the family dining room, where six presidents hung to stare at the naked lady eating grapes. "Is there anything I can do to help, Aunt Elsbeth?" I asked. "No," snapped my aunt. "You don't know how to do anything right, and in the end you only make more work. Why the devil didn't you give Vera the paper dolls when she asked for them?"
"Because she'd only tear them up." My aunt snorted, glared at me, at my mother, whose arms were around me, and then she tugged the vacuum down the hall and disappeared. "Mama," I whispered, "why does Vera always lie? She told Papa I pushed her down the stairs, but I wasn't even near her. I was in the attic, hiding the dolls while she was coming down the stairs. She fell in school, and even then she said I pushed her. Mama, why would she say that when I've never been to school? Why can't I go to school? Did the first Adrena go to school?"
"Yes, of course she went,"
said Mama, sounding as if a frog had caught in her throat.
"Vera is a very unhappy girl, and that's why she lies. Her mother gives her very little attention, and Vera knows you receive a great deal. But it's hard to love such a mean, hateful girl, although we all try our best. There's a cruel streak in Vera that worries me greatly. I'm so afraid she'll do something to hurt you, to hurt us all."
Her lovely violet eyes stared off into space.
"It's too bad your aunt didn't stay away. We didn't need her and Vera to complicate our lives more."
"How old is Vera, Mama?"
"How old has she told you she is?"
"Sometimes Vera says she's 10, sometimes she says she's 12, and sometimes she's 16 or 20. Mama, she laughs like she's mocking me, because I really don't know how old I am."
"Of course you know you are 7. Haven't we told you that over and over again?"
"But I can't remember my 7th birthday. Did you give me a birthday party? Does Vera have birthday parties? I can't remember one."
"Vera is 3 years older than you are,
said Mama quickly. We can't afford to have birthday parties anymore, not because we can't spend the money. But you know why birthday parties bring back tragic memories. Neither your father nor I can bear to think of birthday parties anymore, so we all stopped having birthdays and have chosen to stay the age we like best. I'm going to stay 32. She giggled and kissed me again. That's a lovely age to be, not too young and not too old. But I was serious and sick of evasions. Then Vera didn't know my dead sister, did she? She says she did, but how could she have when she's only 3 years older than me? Again, my mother looked distressed. In a way, she did know her. You see, we've talked so much about her. Perhaps we talked too much about her. And so it went, as always. Evasions, but no revelations. At least not the kind I really wanted. The kind I could believe in. When can I go to school? I asked.
Someday, murmured Mama. Someday soon.
But Mama, I persisted, following her into the kitchen and helping her chop vegetables for the salad. I don't fall and break my bones like Vera, so I'd be safer in school than she is.
No, you don't fall, she said in a tight voice. I suppose I should be grateful for that. But you have other ways of hurting yourself, don't you?
Did I? Papa's Dream. Before darkness could steal the last rosy glow of dusk, Papa was home from the hospital and carrying Vera into the Roman Revival salon. As if Vera weighed only a feather, even with a hip-length cast on her left leg and a fresh cast on her left arm, too, Papa tenderly deposited Vera on the purple velvet couch that my mother loved to keep for herself. Vera appeared very happy with the large box of chocolates she'd half-eaten on her ride home from the hospital. She didn't offer the box to me, though I stood there longing to have just one. Then I saw that Papa had also bought her a new jigsaw puzzle to put together with her good right arm.
"It's all right, honey," he said to me. "I brought you chocolates and a puzzle, too. But you should be grateful you don't have to fall and break your bones just to gain some attention."
Immediately, Vera threw away her puzzle and shoved the chocolates from the table to the floor.
"Now, now," soothed Papa, picking up the boxes and handing them back to her. "Your puzzle is very large. Adrina's is very small. You have a 2-pound box of candy. Adrina's box weighs only 1 pound.
Happy again, Vera smirked my way. "Thank you, Papa. You're so good to me." She stretched her arms forth, wanting him to kiss her. I cringed inside, hating her for calling him Papa when he wasn't her father, but mine. I resented the kiss he put on her cheek, resented, too, that huge box of candy, that larger puzzle that had prettier colors than the one Papa gave me. Unable to bear watching longer, I wandered away to sit on the back veranda and stare at the moon that was coming up over the dark water. It was a quarter moon, what Papa called a horned moon, and I thought I could see the profile of the man in the moon, old and withered-looking. The wind through the summer leaves had a lonesome sound, telling me that soon the leaves would die and winter would come, and I hadn't enjoyed summer at all. I had vague memories of happier, hotter summers, and yet I couldn't pull them out to clearly view them. I put a round piece of chocolate in my mouth, even though we had yet to eat dinner. This August seemed more like October. It really did. As if he heard me calling, Papa came to sit next to me. He sniffed the wind as he always did, an old habit, he'd told me many times, left over from his days in the Navy. "Papa, why are the geese flying south when it's summer? I thought they only flew south in late autumn."
"I guess the geese know more about the weather than we do, and they're trying to tell us something."
His hand lightly brushed over my hair. I started to put another piece of candy in my mouth when he said,
"Don't eat but one of those."
His voice was softer when he spoke to me, kinder, as if my sensitivities were as eggshell fragile as Vera's bones.
"I saw you looking jealous when I kissed Vera. You resented the gifts I gave her. Somebody has to pamper her when she's suffering, and you know only you are the light of my life, the heart of my heart."
"You loved the first Adrina better," I choked. "I'm never going to catch her gift, Papa, no matter how many times I rock in that chair. Why do I have to have her gift? Why can't you take me like I am? With his arm about my shoulders, he explained again that he only wanted to give me confidence in myself.
There's magic to be had in that chair, Adrina. I do love you for what you are. I just want to give you a little extra something that she no longer needs. If you can use what she used to have, why not? Then your Swiss cheese memory would fill to overflowing, and I'd rejoice for you.
I didn't believe there was a gift